Talking Books on News Talk 106 to 108.
I think absolutely many of the things that we do today will be looked back upon in horror. We're no different in that sense. But I believe that we're also no different in the sense that we're not going to figure it out. This is going to be an ongoing battle. It's always going to be an ongoing battle. Politics is not going to go away. And this battle between ensuring the rights of underrepresented people or of the environment, protecting them in the face of intruding, growing, expanding, and ruthless markets, it's a running battle, and I think that will always continue. And we're always going to need to be fighting the good fight.
It is health that is the real wealth, not pieces of gold and silver. The insightful words of Indian politician, activist and writer Mahatma Gandhi. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, we're going to delve deep into the complex, murky and not so glamorous world of the gold jewellery market and ask, how dirty is the gold mining business? This evening, I'm joined by Michael Bloomfield, a Canadian academic and political activist whose latest book, Dirty Gold: How Activism Transformed the Jewellery Industry, has just been published by MIT Press, where Michael argues, history shows us that violence is a stubborn handmaiden of mineral extraction. Precious commodity mining without the spilling of blood has been all too rare, and the gold commodity chain is among the bloodiest. So how do we, yes, you and me, ensure as consumers that our gold is ethically sourced? And how do we make the big fancy brands and your average retailer think and act more ethically?
Hello, my name is Michael Bloomfield. I'm lecturer in international development at the University of Bath. I'm also research associate at the Oxford Department of International Development. I work on the politics of global supply chains, looking at social and environmental justice issues related to global production. I have a particular interest in extractives industry, so I've worked a lot on mining issues in policy and in academia. And my latest publication is called Dirty Gold: How Activism Transformed the Jewelry Industry, which is out with MIT Press.
What a challenging and interesting read, Michael. Dirty Gold, it's such a thought-provoking book. And, for any female listeners out there, and obviously lots of men also, we all love our jewellery and particularly our gold. And it brings up all sorts of ideas and images and symbols, doesn't it? Tell me, when I say the word gold, what comes into your mind?
Well, see, when we think about gold, I think we all think about money. We think about wealth. Gold has always been a symbol of power and prestige, and this has always been the case throughout history and across cultures. I mean, we can think of the ancient Egyptians and the various artifacts that we covet from that time period. We can think of colonial wars. And actually, I mean, even today, gold has a deep significance culturally. In the West, we think of, I don't know, maybe engagement rings. But also in the East, it has a very deep cultural significance in India. And China is quickly becoming the largest market for gold jewelry. So gold is, I mean, over time and across cultures, it has been synonymous with wealth, with power, with prestige.
Do you think it could be argued that societies are still built around gold? If we look at the, you know, ancient Egyptians, the Greeks and so on, clearly gold was a big trader and it had so much, you know, currency, to put it simply. But I'm just wondering, does it still have that traction, absolute traction, do you think?
Well, I think it does. And I mean, it's a great question because it sounds very old fashioned. So gold still underpins the world economy in many ways. And although national currencies aren't linked directly to gold anymore, as the US dollar used to be, governments still hoard vast amounts of gold in order to control currency fluctuations, for example, and as a safe asset. So when the economy goes into a downward spiral, of course, investors stock up on gold because gold has always maintained a fairly consistent value throughout time. I mean, we've been excavating gold, as you said, since Egyptian times. So I think, you know, gold crosses history in that way. And as I said before, I mean, it's incredibly interesting to think that we are still so obsessed with gold, that we still seek gold across the globe. And this goes not just for Western culture, but across cultures.
And when you think about it, every piece of gold has a story. Like, I'm just sitting here today and I'm wearing a piece of Ecuadorian gold, or so I was led to believe when I got it in Ecuador, and I've some Colombian gold as well. But within that, the layers and layers, the supply chains, it's unbelievably complex, isn't it?
Yeah, no, this is exactly the case with gold. So gold, of course, I mean, it comes from a specific place in the ground, but very quickly, gold from a particular source becomes mixed at the refining stage. And not only that, but gold gets mixed with gold from other sources, but gold is also an indestructible element, really. And so all the gold that has ever been mined throughout history remains above ground as gold, and gold gets recycled over time. So, I mean, the best way to think about the complexity of the supply chain, I think, is if you happen to have a piece of gold, look down at that piece of gold and think that gold within that ring, for example, some of it could have come from a large mine in, I don't know, Utah. Some of it could have come from a small mine by subsistence miners in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And some of it may have even been mined by ancient Egyptians 4,000 years ago. So gold is continually mixed and it continually circulates through our economy and through different markets, consumer markets, whether it be jewelry or electronics. And so I think this is important to keep in mind, because when we're trying to trace the source of gold and trying to get at the conditions under which gold is mined, it quickly becomes very, very complex and very difficult. And part of the story that takes place in Dirty Gold is trying to come to terms and develop systems through which we can trace gold and make the mining of gold more responsible.
One of the questions you've asked yourself in Dirty Gold, which I have to say is a rather provocative title for a book, is what is a responsible corporation? And, you know, a responsible corporation, whether it's in Ireland or England and the certain rules that they're bound by, it's very different across different regions around the world, because we all look at that, you know, responsibility in different ways, don't we?
Yeah, I think one of the first things we have to keep in mind when we're thinking about responsible corporation is, well, I mean, I even point out in the book that some people might consider this an oxymoron from what we know about corporate practices across industries. But I think what we consider to be responsible corporate behavior also changes over time, and it's different for different people. So back in 1970, the famous Chicago economist Milton Friedman, he stated that a responsible corporation, or the responsibility of a corporation, is to increase its profits. And what he means by that is that corporations are a specific type of organization, and managers that run corporations have a responsibility to their shareholders, to the owners of that firm. And his point was, if you want corporations to act differently than they do, then you need to regulate them. And that's the job of government. And so for Friedman, I mean, it's sort of a compelling argument in a way, because he's just saying, look, corporations aren't here to decide what is responsible or not. That's the work for democratically elected governments. Corporations just follow the rules. So they're responsible as long as they're obeying the law. But if we dig a little bit deeper, we can see that the argument's slightly disingenuous, in as much as we know also that corporations have extreme power in our society, and they often lobby for regulations that suit their best interests and not necessarily the best interests of society as a whole. So it's clear that it's very important to come to terms with the ways in which corporations think and act. And I think what I'm trying to show in the book is that sometimes corporations are more responsible in certain issue areas and not in others. And sometimes at the same time, different corporations are more or less responsible from one another. And what I'm trying to do is to come to terms with this variation amongst corporations in what they do, in how they think, and how they act, so we can really carefully consider what actually does constitute responsible behavior from these corporations.
It got me thinking as I was progressing through Dirty Gold, Michael, that in a lot of ways, there's not a lot we know about any corporations. Yeah, we know their name. We get annual reports, their trading and so on, their profit margins. They give press, you know, media calls, press and media calls and, you know, talk to their shareholders and so on. But a lot of these big high performance companies, you know, on the NASDAQ or whatever, it can be a shady business between all the regulative bodies that take place. You know, they can operate as kind of sovereign nations in their own right, can't they?
No, they absolutely can. They absolutely can. And they do so in many ways. Of course, the classic way that we think about is corporations lobbying governments to get a regulatory environment that's more conducive to their goals, which is profit maximization and the maximization of shareholder value. But corporations also exercise power in other ways. They have a discursive power, right? They have a power of voice. So when a company like Tiffany & Company, for example, which, as you know, is one of the cases in my book, when they speak about what constitutes a responsible jeweler, that is an exercise of power. And that can be a very positive contribution that corporations can make.
You talk about the supply chain and you say within extractive mining that the gold commodity chain is amongst the bloodiest. Now, they're very provocative words and they're very alarmist to a degree. But I'm just wondering, can you talk me through that?
Yeah, sure. No, exactly. I mean, one of the things I had to come to terms with when I was researching this book was that many of these large mining companies do terrible things and have really a history of violence. Right? Because many of these companies existed in colonial times, for example. And trying to reconcile that with the very nice people that I met that work for these corporations, I mean, that was part of the trick in writing the book. But I don't think that anyone can really dispute that mining has not been accompanied by a very violent past. And so, I mean, it's quite easy to think of conquering armies of the past, of colonialism, which I mentioned, of even nowadays forcing people off land to acquire resources. We could think of the Marikana mine in South Africa and when 40-odd miners were shot and killed by security services. I mean, this is ongoing, and approximately 75% of mineral extraction takes place on indigenous land or land of people that are marginalized in the national discussions over resource extraction and resource use. So this violence comes in multiple forms. When it comes to small-scale mining, of course, there's the violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo that's ongoing. And so this is another example of wars over resources, but also the ways in which these resources can be used to fund these wars. So, you know, it's obviously, to say the least, an unfortunate partnership between violence and mineral extraction. But I think it's one that's difficult to dispute.
Michael, the conflict diamond issue in West Africa has really, I suppose, captured popular culture to a degree. Like, there's been a range of different movies, a lot of books written about it, both in fiction and in non-fiction. And, you know, we've also had plays, theatre and, you know, lots of different approaches on understanding the issue. Do you think, like, the big luxury brands, like, let's say, Cartier or Rolex or Tiffany & Co., one of the ones that you mention in the book, do you think they actually have changed their business practices now because of all the literature and movies and song and dance about the exploitative practices within the diamond manufacturing or within the whole kind of trade in jewellery and extractives?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and they absolutely have. I mean, when the diamond, when the blood diamond or conflict diamond controversy first arose, it caught the jewellery industry somewhat by surprise. They hadn't had to deal with these issues, right? Their job was to make jewelry, to make beautiful things, as well as, of course, you know, maximize shareholder value and all those things we talked about before. But they were interested in selling jewelry. That was their business. Now, all of a sudden, they were being connected to these egregious activities happening halfway around the world, which they may or may not have been directly connected to at the time. And so they were really caught off guard. And with these luxury brands, I mean, it's not hard to imagine that a lot of their value is tied up in their image. So Tiffany and Company, Cartier, these companies that you mentioned, I mean, they are their brand in the similar way that Nike is its brand. So they can contract out different people to make the jewelry. They can buy gold, for example, or diamonds from different companies. They can hire designers to come in and design things for them. What they are is this entity, this, you know, Tiffany is that little blue box. And being connected to these activities, as the activists were well aware, was incredibly risky and dangerous for these brands. And so they learned from this diamond experience. And that's why a lot of these companies were much more proactive and had kind of systems in place when it came to dirty gold.
And it's quite a story because, you know, what actually transpired afterwards was unbelievably impressive. A lot of these shame campaigns can actually bring about massive changes in society, although some people would disagree with them. But I'm just wondering, what's your own view?
Yeah, I mean, these shame campaigns have a huge impact as far as getting corporations to do something. Okay, so they will spur these companies to respond. But what I found and what I explain in the book is really the way in which these companies respond specifically is usually up to the companies and the industry itself. So the activists can kind of create the space in which corporate social responsibility initiatives are formed and different kind of regulatory initiatives are launched, but they are rarely powerful enough to force corporations to do exactly what they want. So the companies kind of enjoy this discretionary space through which they drive their initiatives that kind of meet their business models and the expectations of their customers and their shareholders. So as far as actual impact of these shame campaigns, it's often a mixed bag. And I think, you know, the jewelry industry is doing a very good job at addressing these issues. However, the actual impact on mining practices on the ground, I think that's been quite limited by all accounts.
Can we talk about Brilliant Earth? It's a remarkable story. They were two students from the Stanford School of Business, and they decided to set up a company or a small business based on ethical jewellery. So ethically sourcing different types of metals and jewels and so on. You know, their ethical model, it's really impacted on other suppliers, both high quality and just your average type jewellery store as well, hasn't it? It's quite a profound impact.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. And we see this across industries. It's really in a direct response to these activist campaigns. And in this case, with Brilliant Earth, it's less to do with the gold, although they're heavily involved in the politics around gold now, but more to do with what we were talking about before, the conflict diamonds. So activists, in a way, when they politicize markets in this way, they create opportunities for new markets to form, in this case, ethical markets. And Brilliant Earth is such an interesting company because they are a quintessential market response to these types of campaigns. And that's not to say that the founders of Brilliant Earth don't believe in these issues. They absolutely do, and they're doing some incredible work to push companies to be more responsible and really raising the bar as to what constitutes an ethical jewelry company. But they're also business people. As you said, they were at Stanford Business School doing MBAs. They saw a market opportunity. They were looking for ethical products in their own personal lives, looking for an engagement ring. Could not find a guaranteed ethically sourced engagement ring in the Bay Area. And so they decided that they would supply that ring and supply that market. And so that's why I use them. There's many other ethical jewelers in the market. Some are even started by activists, again, using markets to try to push this agenda. But I really thought Brilliant Earth was just such a great example of the way in which you can kind of politicize markets and the market will change. The market will respond to meet that new demand
When you say the politics of gold just there, Michael, I'm just wondering what you mean by that in terms of how far does it reach? Like, you know, how politically active are a lot of these big gold mining groups, and how, you know, what is their access to the real corridors of power?
Oh, yeah. I mean, in this way, we kind of have to differentiate between there's the gold mining companies, and there's different types of gold mining companies, and then there are the traders of gold, and there are the refiners of gold, and there are, of course, gold jewelers. So gold jewelers were targeted by activists because they knew that the gold jewelers would respond, and that would hopefully get some of the miners to the table. But when we're talking about power, I mean, we really do need to talk about the gold miners themselves. Many of these companies are, you know, they're some of the largest companies in the world, and they have incredible access to corridors of power. I mean, as I said before, I'm from Canada, and the Toronto Stock Exchange, the TSX, is the major center where gold mining companies are listed. And they do impact, when they get together, they impact the types of regulation that are in place in Canada and abroad. And so, I mean, there is a story of one opposition minister in Canada that tried to put forward a bill to control Canadian companies working abroad to ensure that they weren't encouraging human rights abuses by security services or complicit in that type of negative activity. So he tabled this bill that said, okay, well, we can't regulate these companies working abroad because, you know, it's out of our jurisdiction. That's up to the countries in which they're operating. But many of these companies enjoy subsidies from Canadian taxpayers, things like, you know, from Export Development Canada, so on and so forth. And they said, we could at least deny companies that are charged with these types of egregious activities, we could deny them taxpayer subsidies at the very least. Now, the mining industry hated this. They thought this was a terrible idea, that it would be politicized, it would be terrible for business. And they got together and they killed it in its tracks. And that show of business power, the way in which they had lobbyists going into Parliament to lobby, they hired an ex-minister who sort of, again, disingenuously said, he said, I can't speak for CEOs of these companies, but if I were one of these CEOs, then I would strongly consider moving my business abroad because of the ability to politicize this type of law. And this is the way business operates, to kind of send a regulatory chill, if you will, through policymakers by, again, using their voice to vocalize these types of threats. Policymakers then say, ooh, we're going to be punished by these companies and by markets and maybe eventually by voters if we kind of overregulate in this way. And so this is, you know, it's kind of a great example of the ways in which these big industries and these big companies, once they put their mind to it, can really impact the corridors of power and the regulation.
How did you go about investigating that, though? Because clearly you're an academic and, you know, you use possibly certain types of disciplines and approaches. But if the links between business and politics are so murky and so deep and so hidden, I'm just wondering, how do you go about probing that and poking at it and opening it up? Because it's not clear cut.
No, it's not always clear cut. So we use a variety of methods. So I talk to people, right? I interview activists. I interview government officials. I interview leaders in industry groups. I interview executives in the corporations themselves. And I try to kind of reverse engineer what happened, if you will. So I put together these historical events. I mean, that example that I used, the Canadian example, a lot of the work in that one was done for me because that's just classic investigative journalism. But you can put this together through talking to the different people, through studying different industry documents and what we call the gray literature. Yeah, and there's different, of course, freedom of information laws. But I mean, a lot of the work that I do in the book is not, I'm not really looking for a smoking gun. I'm looking at the good ones. I think there's a lot to learn from the corporations that really lead the positive engagement with these types of political issues. And I don't think our theories or the existing theories explained what made these firms different from other companies that don't respond or react oppositionally to these types of politics. And I think it's important to learn how these firms kind of break out of that and become more responsible companies.
Michael, I'm all for the positive storytelling around it and, you know, sending out and enforcing positive messages. And I do think that, you know, if you go down all these negative roads, you don't inspire in any way. It's very hard to bring about change. But then, you know, like, do you ever ask yourself that, okay, you made your way into work today. You, I don't know, you got up in the morning, you had something to eat, you went into work, you did this, A, B and C, whatever. And within all of that, extractives are some types of murky business. You're interfacing with it whether you choose to or not, or whether you're consciously aware of it. For example, yeah, I'm wearing gold jewellery today. I'm also using a mobile phone. I've used two computers today. There's metals, there's extractives in all of those mobile phones, whatever it is. You know, I get on a plane next week, I do whatever. You can be very clean, let's say, in your gold wearing practices, but it's very hard to kind of take that high moral ground and everything, down to even the food we eat.
No, I think you're absolutely correct. It is really difficult. And that's why, you know, people are, in that respect, it's difficult. I mean, it's difficult to be a person, full stop, but it's difficult to be a responsible consumer, isn't it? As you said, I mean, with gold, you can see it. And hopefully, if you can afford it, you can afford an ethical ring that you know where it came from. And hopefully you have faith in the traceability of that system that's in place to help you be a responsible consumer. But like you said, when it comes to mineral extraction, it's everywhere. It's everywhere around us. And that's where, you know, I mean, that's where the activists come in, by providing this information. It's difficult to have the information, and it's difficult to know how to act on the information. And sometimes it's difficult to always act.
But we all have fine ideals in life, you know, Michael, but it's sometimes very hard to implement those because they do come at a cost. Okay, it could be that you've to walk down three different streets in an extra way to go to a little small shop to buy, let's say, for me to buy Irish food and not buy out of a British store, let's say, for example, or to buy organic. It all comes at a price, and either the price is the time that you're putting into it. You know, you have to go and jump an extra hoop or two, or then within that, it's quite costly. So you can see why some people get all very cynical, you know, to be the good doer, you know?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I mean, there's another great book on MIT Press, Environmentalism for the Rich by Peter Duverne, where he discusses these exact issues. And is it enough? Is ethical consumerism enough? And not only is it enough, but is it always positive? Because in fact, it might just be encouraging us to consume our way to some better planet. And of course, most of us realize that this is not the way to go about it. We need to conserve. We need to have laws in place. We need to shift institutions. We don't want to completely individualize responsibility when it comes to these issues. And so, yeah, I mean, I agree with you, Sue. I mean, and don't let me put words in your mouth, but in some ways, you know, ethical consumption can be seen as a bit of a privileged category. And so it's certainly not the only answer.
Can't live without me. fira koblengi baru nanyuma koho kibaru wolonde ni toroni lole ni komoto fete wolomu soye adi aladeni. Majabi masaja la kibali masaha majabi
You're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on this evening's show, I'm joined by Michael Bloomfield from the University of Bath, whose latest book, Dirty Gold, has just been published by MIT Press, where Michael states, even the gold jewellery market itself is not a single market. Gold jewellery is sold in multiple countries, often by traders without recognisable brands. Consumer leverage is located where the money is. Thus, targeting retailers in rich countries has been a favoured strategy for activists. I asked Michael about his trip to Walmart's headquarters in Bentonville, Arkansas, and the company's noble push on sustainability, both in terms of environmental action and in supply chain management.
They're a really surprising company. I mean, I as you said, I went to their headquarters and I was even surprised to get access to their headquarters because they don't usually respond to researcher requests in that way. But it's a company that is changing. I don't want to romanticize Walmart. The activists, I mean, they barely even targeted Walmart. Walmart is the largest, is one of the largest companies in the world. They sold almost $500 billion worth of stuff last year. They're the largest jeweler in the world as far as revenues go. You don't really associate them with gold jewelry, but they sell a lot of 9-carat gold jewelry and they just sell so much of it. It makes them a huge player with huge impact. Now, the activists barely targeted them because, like you said, they didn't think they would do anything. I mean, Walmart has a history of ignoring activist complaints. Usually they've been around labor standards and whatnot. So when the activists, I mean, they did kind of mention their name in passing in some of the advertisements they took out in which they praised the companies that were good. And in Walmart's case at the time, they had them on the laggards list. And they were really surprised when they got this call from Bentonville, Arkansas, and said, you know, help us get off this laggards list, help us get some good gold. And so they went down to Walmart and they started, or, you know, down to Bentonville, Arkansas, and started working with the company. The way in which I explain this in the book is because it fit into a larger sustainability initiative that Walmart had launched. Okay, so they launched, I think, what could be considered the largest private sector-led sustainability initiative ever. And that's just by nature of the size of the company and its impact. They launched that in 2005. And they did so because they were starting to have image problems. As I said, they've often ignored it. They've gotten by on just sort of selling a lot of stuff for cheap, and their customers tended not to care about it. But all of a sudden, they're trying to expand into areas, into urban areas, into, you know, California, overseas. And all of a sudden, they were starting to get some pushback from customers, but also from city councilors who didn't want this big store, this big box retailer in their jurisdiction because of, you know, all of those image issues around labor, around driving small businesses out of business, around encouraging suburban sprawl. So Walmart did all of a sudden have an image issue. But even that wasn't enough. I mean, why did they launch this initiative? It's a tricky question. But really, at the end of the day, there was this enabling environment to do with their business model that I just explained. But there was also leadership present. So they had the right people in the right positions that saw this image issue and said, okay, you know what? We're going to push this forward. We're going to do something for the environment. Of course, they didn't really improve immediately their labor conditions. But they did launch this huge environmental sustainability initiative. They do sustainability in a very particular way, right? If it costs money, they get rid of it. Okay, so they're looking for kind of win-win type situations. But because Walmart's so powerful, because they have over 100,000 suppliers worldwide stretching across the globe, because they have 2.2 million employees, because they have, you know, their logistical systems are so complex and so impactful, the little things that they do really do mean something. And that's where this kind of gold campaign fit into. And that's the way in which kind of issue areas can kind of bleed over into one another, right? So we talked about the conflict diamonds, and without the conflict diamonds, I don't think we would have gotten the gold. And similar story with Walmart. Without activists bringing up these labor issues, I don't think you would have seen Walmart's action in the gold sphere either. So it's a very surprising company in a lot of ways. And it's a company that I didn't have access to at first either. I was sending emails and they weren't responding to me. I was getting very polite, rejections for my request for interview. But I realized that they're in this tiny little town in Arkansas, and being Canadian, I know what small towns are like. I know how they work. And so I just said, you know what? I'm just going to go there. I'm going to hang out. And when they see me, they'll talk to me. And sure enough, that's what happened. And so in the book, I have a lot of kind of exclusive information, which was really great. It was quite an experience to enter this headquarters and kind of go through the motions of getting into this, you know, the belly of the beast, if you will.
It's quite an inspiring story, but I'm just wondering, not every activist can work with a big international business organization, whether they're in food production, extractives, IT, financial services, whatever it is, because methods can differ. So, you know, that's a, you know, it's a great story. But you think that it is possible maybe to get different types of activists to engage in meaningful ways with big companies, and companies also to engage with in meaningful and purposeful ways with activists. Like, do you think that's possible? Do you think we're evolving that way? Like, you mentioned Milton Friedman there at the start of the interview, and he said famously that, you know, the sole focus for any company is really to make profit. But profit now has, I suppose, expanded its terms of reference to include reputational risk and damage and all of that, and all the kind of connotations that go with that. And within that, the brand is, you know, it's not just about being a visible brand, it's about being kind of a decent brand, if you will.
No, absolutely. In some ways, it was Naomi Klein that kind of started the conversation about this kind of branding boomerang, if you will, the ways in which activists could use the carefully curated brands of huge companies in some ways against them. And so, you know, in the words of one activist, it was like these shame campaigns were like discovering gunpowder, because all of a sudden they had access into these markets. They could force these companies to respond to them because they created risk. And when most of your value is wrapped up in this intangible brand, you can't have that risk. Risk is intangible, but it's enough. You just sort of have to raise the threat, and these companies need to do something to protect their brand. In that way, it's been quite impactful. But I really liked the first part of your question when you were talking about, can all activists do this? And not really, right? You need different types of activists. And you see that. You see a real kind of division of labor. It's not always coordinated, but you see a division of labor happening in activist groups. So you've got the kind of, what I like to think of as like the attack dogs of the activist sphere. And they're the ones that target these corporations. They do the naming and shaming campaigns. But the thing is, the companies, even if they want to respond, they don't want to necessarily work with those attack dogs. They don't trust them. Those activists and their organizations are not necessarily built to work directly with corporations. And of course, they're at risk themselves. These activist groups are at risk of being co-opted by these huge corporations or appearing to be co-opted. So they have their own brand to protect as well. But what you do have is you have different types of activist groups. You have the bigger NGOs. More and more Greenpeace has been doing this, although they used to be one of the attack dogs. You've got the Environmental Defense Fund. You've got Conservation International. And these are the big organizations that then step in. They step into that gap that the attack dogs have kind of formed, and they work with the companies. So the companies are lost, right? The companies say, okay, well, now you've told us what we're doing wrong. How do we fix it? And these bigger organizations come in and work with them. It's not an unproblematic partnership by any means, but that's sort of the division of labor.
You mentioned Tiffany's in Dirty Gold, and you talk a lot about how the, you know, it was actually the top guy in there, the chief executive at the time, who genuinely was determined to fix up and clean up the gold operations. And, you know, whether it was supply chains, how they were manufacturing, he just wanted to clean. He genuinely, hand in heart, had a passion for it and an interest and was enthusiastic. But I'm just wondering, are we moving towards a greater listening? Are we becoming more compassionate manufacturers, more fairer traders? Are we becoming more sensible in how we go about business?
That's a good question. I think, I mean, maybe finally, Sue, you may have tapped into my cynical side, because I'm not sure I'm ready to claim that the business is becoming more compassionate as a whole. And there's new challenges arising as these different trade patterns shift from Europe and the US, where these activist campaigns have been operating for many years, developing these ethical markets, and where they start moving more towards emerging economies that don't necessarily have that history of activist pressure, the regulations in place, or the fledgling ethical markets. So I'm not quite ready to claim that we're becoming more compassionate. But we are seeing, I think, an increasing engagement of corporations in global politics through things like corporate social responsibility and through various certification initiatives. And the kind of counterintuitive way in which I think this is working, and what I argue in the book, is that activists actually enable this. So activists, by politicizing markets, they sort of free up proactive executives within companies to mobilize the firm's resources, because this all costs money, and they allow them, they give them kind of a business case for acting politically. Now, this is both good and bad. The good is that you get a lot of companies like Tiffany & Company that's leading the charge and finding new and more positive ways of engaging in these industries and are therefore impacting people on the planet and more positive. So there is a good side to this. The bad side is, of course, that if companies are doing all the heavy lifting, these companies are the ones that are defining what constitutes sustainability, what constitutes a responsible corporation, what should be done in mineral extraction to make it more sustainable. They're doing this on their own terms. And of course, even forward-thinking executives within these companies, they're doing so within a certain type of institution, an institution that has a mandate to maximize profits and maximize shareholder value. So there's sort of this hierarchy of priorities that's being entrenched, which puts this business model and these kind of market logics above sustainability, and you kind of engage with sustainability in a way that fits that business model. And I think most of us, when it's put that way, would hope that it were the other way around. The sustainability, the people on the planet should be our top priority, and then you build business models that fit that, that encourage that.
On a personal level, Michael, how do you deal with all the willful ignorance around, whether it's within politicians, businesses, small or large, and even your average consumer? How do you deal with it all? Because you have spent years and years researching all of this stuff. I've read one book, as in Dirty Gold, and it was a little bit in parts inspiring, but also very sad to read other in other aspects and other realities. So I'm just wondering, how do you balance that?
Yeah, it's tough. On a personal level, like I said, I really struggled with coming face to face with all these people where, you think of Walmart as a big evil corporation. And indeed, there's lots of evidence to support that perspective historically. And then you go there and you realize that there's people there, right? There's just people. And some of them are nice and some of them aren't nice. And I tend to be probably too patient with people. I really like people. And I try to understand why they do the things they do, and that extends to consumers and myself and everyone else, but certainly to corporate executives as well. And so I guess when I'm writing a book like this, I'm trying to show the ways in which people can make a difference, but also the ways in which people can be channeled in directions where they're certainly not intending to do something bad, right? They're certainly not intending. I mean, maybe there's some that are, but they're usually not intending to have negative impacts on people in faraway places. And so I think, well, how can this person be channeled in this direction? And then you start thinking about the organization within which they're embedded, the culture of that organization, the regulations in place, the demands put upon those people. And that's where I think you can find change, right? So and then you start thinking, okay, well, how can we rebuild this in a way in which otherwise caring people that go home to their families and can be very caring, just to keep them from inadvertently or, you know, maybe sometimes advertently as well, committing acts that are not the most productive.
Last question for you, Michael. I'm just wondering, do you think in about 100 or 150 years' time, we look back at the 21st century and our families and friends and distant relatives or whatever and think, Jesus Christ, what a bunch of barbarians. Like, do you think we'll have evolved? Like, are you hopeful that we can be optimistic that things will actually get better?
Yes and no. Yes and no. I think absolutely many of the things that we do today will be looked back upon in horror. We're no different in that sense. But I believe that we're also no different in the sense that we're not going to figure it out. This is going to be an ongoing battle. It's always going to be an ongoing battle. Politics is not going to go away. And this battle between ensuring the rights of underrepresented people or of the environment, protecting them in the face of intruding, growing, expanding, and ruthless markets, it's a running battle. And I think that will always continue. And we're always going to need to be fighting the good fight.
Thank you.
Canadian political activist, writer and researcher, Dr. Michael Bloomfield. Dirty Gold, How Activism Transformed the Jewellery Industry is published by MIT Press and retails for in and around €28 in hardback. Now, I have to say hats off to Michael. Dirty Gold is an eye-opening read. It's accessible, well-argued and will really make you think how you go about purchasing your next piece of jewellery. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say thank you for listening and a big shout out to the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been talking books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the courageous words of Michael Bloomfield, who in his conclusions to Dirty Gold writes, "The examples I offer in this book are certainly not examples of the invisible green hand of the market at work. They are the exact opposite. They are the work of a collection of very visible hands. They are examples of political agency at work. Too true. Good night."
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.